morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Michael Zinser, and I'm here this morning to represent the Santa Barbara News Press. This case involves small community newspaper in Santa Barbara, California, daily circulation of about 35,000 circulation, and the newsroom employees and the graphic communications conference of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And in July 2006, the newsroom employees presented ownership with a list of four demands. The first demand, demand number one, the central demand, restore journalism ethics to the Santa Barbara News Press. And they defined that implement and maintain a clear separation between the opinion side of the paper and the news gathering side of the paper. And that was hand-delivered to Travis Armstrong, then acting publisher. He was told that he had 72 hours to deal with it or a boycott was going to commence. Now, this demand number one, for purposes of this case, was never withdrawn. Now, the employees did not think that the owner of the newspaper should interfere with the news, and the employees determined that when the publisher directed them not to publish a story about Mr. Armstrong's DUI sentencing, that that was interfering with their ability to write the news.
I understand your position on that, but can you point to a specific ULP found by the board where the company defended expressly on the basis that the company had acted simply to protect its control over these issues, over this, what broadly understood are editorial control issues?
Well, Your Honor, the a review of the record, I mean, that was initially stated before the ALJ, and that was litigated throughout the proceedings,
But the ALJ very often, perhaps always, seems to confront justifications by the employer, which are different from this, and which he or she rejects as pretextual. So, in other words, the nexus between your claim about who has editorial control of a newspaper isn't as clearly brought into focus in these specific issues as your argument assumes. At least I haven't, to put it more carefully, I haven't found instances where that's the case.
Well, again, Your Honor, I believe that it was thoroughly presented to the ALJ.
Just one that clearly focuses on that.
Well, with respect to an exhibit, I cannot do that at this time.
Well, I don't mean an exhibit. I mean one specific ULP that where the board's. I'm sorry, the employer's defense is basically, for example, you have acted, the person in question has acted disloyally in that he or she has disparaged the product of the company, disparaged the product of the company on matters not relating to mandatory subjects of bargaining.
Well, your Honor, that was the overriding, one of the overriding defenses throughout the hearing.
You say it's overriding, but in the ALJ's lengthy opinion, the focus seems to be on other justifications which the ALJ discards as pretextual.
Well, of course, we obviously don't agree with the ALJ's decision, and that's
I know, but on
that's,
that, on that
that's why we're here. And
reference on the facts problem.
And I think a review is a very lengthy record, but I think a review of the record will reveal that in fact Santa Barbara News Press did do that, and in fact
useful to focus on in your brief.
And in fact, there was a proceeding in the U.S. District Court in California as well as the Ninth Circuit. So it clearly has been a big issue. And with respect to the board's opinion in this case, it felt compelled to address it as well. And I think, you know, so much of the testimony, reporter Melinda Burns at a rally shortly after the demands were made, the question before us is, will the news press reflect the world as Wendy McCall sees it, or will it reflect the lives and hopes and vision of the entire community, part of the testimony of the case?
As reflected in the reporter's decisions.
And Burns went on to testify, well, I don't think I want to work for a vanity press where every article in the paper reflects the editors, the publishers, the owners' views, but rather I want to be a serious journalist. I want to be able to fairly report news as...
I mean, I understand entirely that is the underlying dispute.
And the...
It's not necessarily the exclusive underlying dispute, but the primary underlying dispute. But then when it comes down to it, the employer, in justifying specific acts, seems to point more to various things, not that, things which are found to be pretextual.
And the union organizer on a live radio show, Your Honor, he stated, someone asked the other day, well, why is your union so intensely involved in this? The fact is that labor unions understand that the voice in those communities are the newspapers. If we cannot get stories about situations that arise in the paper, in the communities, into those newspapers, or we can't tell an opposite side of a story, or for that matter present an opposition, a position, that is where the death or the possible death of democracy starts.
Does the company point to that as the justification, did the company in the proceedings before the board point to that as the justification for acts claim to be ULPs?
Well, for example, the employees that were discharged were hanging the banner over the freeway. I mean, clearly
the company defended on the grounds that it had no idea this had any connection with the labor dispute at all. But since the labor dispute was interwoven with the editorial control dispute, that doesn't seem to add up in terms of bringing us back to the rights the company had to control its editorial policy.
Well, two things, Your Honor. The at the point in time all of this is happening, okay, the union has not been yet certified as the, you know, representative of these employees. That doesn't happen until August of 2007.
Yeah.
So the only thing going on right now, I mean, at that time, is this campaign in the community to take over the content of the paper, okay, backed by the Teamsters Union, with a boycott that started with subscribers and later was extended to advertisers. And so with respect to the freeway banner issue and situation, clearly
a call for the employer to say the employer didn't understand it had anything to do with the union activities, because you've just said the whole, I think correctly, the whole unionization effort was directed to seizing editorial control.
Well, we don't believe, Your Honor, that the banner had anything to do with union activity. I think
your argument is the two are, and actually you won before the district court on this, on the inseparability of the two.
Well, that the conduct, the campaign to try to take over the content of the paper, that wasn't union activity. That was an unlawful or improper goal to try to take over the content.
I understand your point on that, but you also argue that the reporters trying to advance that goal chose unionization as their tool. So it's pretty hard when you confront the banner across Highway 101 to say, oh, we had no idea it had anything to do with unionization. You have, and as I say, you won on this before the district court and the Ninth Circuit, argued that the two are inseparably locked together.
Well, no question that said they said they were locked together. There's no question about that, Your Honor. But the alternative, the second thing I would say, the with respect to the banner itself, it's significant, and what we argued in the brief and before the board is that on the banner, there's nothing addressing, you know, wages and hours. There's nothing even mentioning the union. And if you look at the United States Supreme Court,
did you raise the defense, preserve the defense in the administrative litigation, the First Amendment related defense that you seem to be relying upon here?
I absolutely believe we did, Your Honor.
That absolutely believe has been reported to us several times. Could you absolutely believe it's at some particular page in the record that we could find, or?
You know, I can't at this time, because unfortunately, Your Honor, I didn't anticipate that was an
issue.
Probably
should have anticipated we'd ask you about this sort of thing, counsel. What was your client's position with reference to the ULP involving the cancellation of Starshine Rochelle's column?
Clearly that it had the right to do that, that at the time.
If you raised this defense somewhere, wasn't it with reference to the Starshine Rochelle ULP?
It probably was raised with respect to that, but among other issues, not just that one, Your Honor. And then, you know, with respect to the discharges of Burns and Davison for biased reporting, clearly the record with respect to biased reporting is overwhelming. I mean, these were not just single instances. And year after year, both of these individuals in their performance reviews had been told about the bias in their writing, and clearly this is also a content issue, if you will, Your Honor, in that the Santa Barbara News Press decided that, you know, it no longer was going to tolerate this content.
The right line issue at this point, though, as to what your client's animus was in the commission, alleged commission of those ULPs.
And we're asking the court to look at a different standard because of the
what we're concerned with. Is, did you ask the board to? And I'm suggesting that perhaps you did with respect to the Sunshine Rochelle column, but I'm not sure that the record supports the proposition that you did with respect to the other ULPs.
And the board in its decision specifically addressed the request for the heightened burden of proof, and I don't believe their decision limited it to Star Sign Rochelle's column.
I'm going to check that.
But the it appears to Santa Barbara News Press that what the
they did refer to it with respect to the other ULPs. I'll take that back. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. You know, with respect to the First Amendment issue, this honorable court, you know, owes the NLRB no deference with respect to its analysis on that issue. And, you know, we believe the NLRB's decision is aimed at strengthening the union and the employees' hand against the ownership of the newspaper in the battle for content control. And you know, it surely wasn't the premise of the National Labor Relations Board in its decision that the newspaper owner is going to prevail and that the employee's efforts to control the content is just for naught. I mean, it's clearly designed to encourage them to pursue wresting control of the content of the Santa Barbara News Press away from the owner. And as the it's the NLRB trying to regulate, if you will, the First Amendment, and as the Supreme Court said in the Miami Herald case, the First Amendment erects a virtually insurmountable barrier between government and the print media so far as government tampering in advance of publication with news and editorial content is concerned.
But did the other ULPs, possible exception of the Rochelle column, really concern content?
The Without question, two discharges concerning the reporting, the biased reporting, that's clearly content. And with respect to the discharges with respect to the freeway, the boycott effort was part of the union employees' effort, again, to put pressure on this company to cede to it control of the content of the newspaper.
Okay, thank you, Council.
Does the record indicate how successful the boycott was?
Well,
I always wonder about employees trying to destroy their employer's business.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is testimony by the owner, Mrs. McCall, that during this period of time, the number of subscribers decreased as a result of the boycott.
Almost all newspapers had seen declining subscriptions.
Exactly.
Well, but this was back in 2006 and 2007, and
going on quite a while.
Mm-hmm. But that's the testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Council. Your time is up. We'll give you back a couple of minutes if you need it. We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Kira Wall for the National Labor Relations Board. As Your Honors have suggested, the Board here found that the company responded to the reporter's quest for unionization with a series of coercive and retaliatory actions directed at employees because of and in retaliation for and to discourage their efforts to obtain union representation.
Let's go back, though, to the approach your brief, I think, correctly takes, which is to start with an account of how this dispute began, which focuses on essentially editorial control. Let me just ask you, if autonomy, which is the employee's term for their controlling editorial decisions as opposed to the ownership, if autonomy was not the main goal of the various employee actions, why does the board spend so much time in your brief and actually the board decision itself defending autonomy, reporter autonomy, as something they're entitled to press for? It seems completely illogical.
Well, Your Honor, the board did find that there were a number of goals for the union campaign, but clearly autonomy was one of them. And was one that they discussed regularly and often, and the employer's
main current... Well, so if we look at, for example, the boycott, then why doesn't the presence of that goal, clearly stated and often stated, as you've just said, why doesn't that make the company's response to the boycott simply an effort to protect its editorial rights? Or, I don't really understand, reading the board's opinion, what the board is trying to say about who has editorial rights in a newspaper. They seem to, you, the board, and your brief seem to assume that reporters' autonomy encompasses, for example, the right to decide whether the paper should give the address of someone who has fallen into news relevance, whether the paper should cover a DUI for a particular editor.
Well, I think that those
sound like editorial prerogatives to me.
I believe the board's decision makes clear that the board recognizes that the First Amendment right adheres to the company and that the company has every right to establish.
It isn't clear to me. It isn't at all clear to me from the board's opinion.
Well, I believe...
And your brief, too, constantly talks in terms of the employees seeking to defend and advance reporters' autonomy, which in this context of this case simply means control over editorial choice.
Well, if I may, I think that there's a distinction between what an employee may, the board may recognize that an employee has a right to advocate and discuss and promote and seek support for concertedly with fellow employees, and that employee's right. In other words, I think the board clearly recognizes in its decision that the employees have no right to require these changes, but just that they have a right because of these changes.
I mean, in labor law, they never have a right to require anything. They have a right, for example, to bargain over it, and with certain subjects, they have a right to disparage the employer publicly.
Well, and of course, Your Honor, here the board did not even find a right to bargain over this issue because that question has not yet been presented, was certainly not presented in this case. What the board held was that employees, you know, speaking in broader terms, have the right to, there were a number of aspects of this campaign that were protected. They have a right, obviously, to seek representation and bargaining with respect to terms and conditions of employment, which some of, you know, the policies we've discussed were terms because they had disciplinary consequences up to termination. But the board also acknowledged...
Slow down on that. You're saying that editorial control is a term of employment within the meaning of the Act?
No, Your Honor, I did not mean to.
Well, you said that these issues were, were being pressed as a matter of advancing the workers' interests in terms and conditions of employment.
Well, there. Certain issues, and for example, they wanted to negotiate about wages, are clearly terms and conditions of employment.
Yeah, was that of any great weight in this case?
Well, this case takes place before the board, largely before the employees voted for the union in September 06, but because of objections and proceedings, the union was not certified.
Yeah, the board, as your brief reflects, sees the whole story, right? And the whole story is one essentially about editorial control.
I simply meant to suggest that the opportunity hadn't really arisen to bargain over terms because bargaining hadn't really started this case.
But it relates very directly to disparagement of the employer, which has been a constant method used by the employees in this case.
Well, I would like to back up and just remind the court, as you already pointed out, that in taking the adverse actions that the board found to be unfair labor practices in this case, the company did not use as a justification for those actions at the time or largely for the individual actions at the hearing. The fact that there was, the issue of editorial control, the company raised that after as a broad defense, but the fact is, for example, for the column cancellation, the company's primary argument, which the ALJ, substantial evidence supports the ALJ's discrediting of this rationale, had to do with a business plan, and that the testimony in support of that was entirely discredited. Now, much of the employer's testimony before the board was discredited, and the employer does not...
I have to say, with respect to the column cancellation in particular, though, that I'm troubled by the idea that the government can make any inquiry into the motivation of a publisher in canceling a column. It seems to me that Associated Press, which you cite and rely on, granted it's dicta, but makes it very plain that the First Amendment right of the newspaper owner extends to deciding what he's going to publish for any or no reason, and isn't it an encroachment on the First Amendment rights of the protected person for the government, in this case the NLRB, to be inquiring as to why they canceled the column? I mean, we're not talking about a firing there. We're talking about the cancellation of print from the newspaper. And I don't honestly immediately see how you have defended the right of the NLRB to even inquire into the decision of a publisher as to what to publish.
Well, I believe that the Supreme Court in Associated Press and this court in, I believe, Press Company and Passaic rejected newspaper or media employers' sort of general defense that...
Certainly. They're subject to the labor laws. But Associated Press, petitioner is at liberty, referring to the publisher, whenever occasion may arise, to exercise its undoubted right to sever his relationship for any cause that seems proper, it goes on to say, let me see if I can find it, I think it makes it very plain that the publisher has the right to determine what it's going to publish, and I don't see where you're finding in that case or our case is either one an authority on the part of the government to inquire into the motives of a publisher and what it published.
Well, and I want to be clear here. I think that what the courts rejected was the broad defense that the newspaper need not even explain its decisions whatsoever if they relate to anyone who has to do with content. That right line doesn't apply, that the board has no right to inquire into motives. And in
Wait a minute. We don't have any case where that has been held with respect to the content of a newspaper, do we? You can inquire into the Rochelle case, ULP, is different from the others. We're not talking about a firing. She quit. We're talking about the decision to not publish her column. And I don't think Associated Press or any of our cases have involved an inquiry into what to publish, have they?
Well, the unfair labor practice in Passaic, I believe, Your Honor, was the cancellation of a column. And this court,
the board of column, or was it the firing of the column?
With respect to my reading of the case,
it's demotion in the form of taking him off
the column.
Yeah.
Right. With respect, I don't think he was fired. I think
it was demotion. It was a job action and not just the cancellation of the column. But all you're dealing with here in Starshine Rochelle's case, love that name, is the cancellation of her column. And Associated Press said the order of the board in that case in no wise circumscribes the full freedom and liberty of the petitioner to publish the news as it desires it published, or to enforce policies of its own choosing with respect to the editing and rewriting of news publications. And the petitioner is, and then it goes on into discharge. But as far as the content of the paper, I don't see where Associated Press supports you on that.
Well, and the board does make clear here that it is not making any judgment on the newspaper's editorial policies or positions.
It doesn't really make that clear. It doesn't make that clear because, at least implicitly, in some cases I think explicitly, it deliberately supports the employee's interest in what it calls autonomy, which is a fancy word for control over editorial policy. I mean, your brief distinguishes between deciding whether paper will endorse Romney or Obama, but there are a lot of other editorial decisions that actually are very much involved here.
I do want to refer the board to page 6 of the DNO of the board's decision, which I think is A2820 in the appendix. And where the board states, our decision does not suggest in any manner that the decisions that triggered employees organizing the protest activities were wrongful. Thus, our order leaves all of the respondents' policies and procedures related to the contents, editorial approval, and publication of articles fully intact.
Yeah, but am I not correct that the board did find or uphold a ULP that the ALJ had found with respect to the cancellation of the column?
That is correct, and I do think that it was an analogous ULP to the one that this court upheld in Passaic, where the demotion was, in fact, as it is in this case, the demotion was the removal of the column. The individual in Passaic who wrote the column, I believe near the beginning of the Passaic decision, it talks about how during the entire relevant period held the same job, I'm assuming the same pay and benefits. I mean, the demotion, in quotes, in Passaic was the removal of his column writing duties, which he testified, made him unhappy.
Suppose for a moment that you didn't have Passaic decide. Just forget that it's been decided. How would you defend the First Amendment argument, defend the argument in a case of first instance that the NLRB can't inquire into the reasons of a publisher for deciding what to publish in her newspaper?
Well, I don't want to defend that exact proposition because I don't think
you've got a ULP that says you committed a ULP by not publishing this particular item.
Well,
how can you defend with the First Amendment in view, without citing Passaic, which we can dispute whether it stands for it or not, how can you defend the NLRB having the authority to do that?
Well, I believe, and this may seem semantic, but I think that the ULP is not in exactly how you describe it, because the board does make clear that for any given column that Ms. Rochelle writes, should the company desire not to publish it, it has every right to omit it from the newspaper.
Why can't it just say we're anxious about the sort of columns you write and you're off it, right?
Well,
I mean, you're saying the only method the newspaper can exercise editorial control is sort of column by column basis.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't mean to suggest that, but what the board found, the only thing the company cannot do is to remove Ms. Rochelle permanently from her role as a columnist because of and in retaliation for unfair labor practices. However,
you mean retaliation for protected for, conduct.
Excuse me,
so
for
what
protected
is the protected conduct?
From Ms. Rochelle?
Is it the content of her column?
No. The judge, you know, described a number of the judge conducted essentially a right line analysis. The company's position was, by the way, not that this was an editorial discretion issue. The company's or not a content issue with respect to the content of Ms. Rochelle's columns. The company's position before the board and to Ms. Rochelle directly when terminating her role as a columnist was that this was a business plan. They wanted to
You only get to right line when the general counsel has initially carried its burden of showing the connection.
So,
but let me just call your attention to a couple of things said by the Ninth Circuit. And I know you say the Ninth Circuit decision had a special context, and I agree, but I'm only pointing to it for a couple of observations that seem analytically relevant. We think that approach, basically the idea that the injunction you were seeking then doesn't require the paper to change its editorial policy, we think that approach closes its eyes to what the underlying labor dispute here is about, the ability of the newspaper owner and publisher to exercise control over the news pages. And another point, and this is even more relevant to how the right line analysis could work in this context, under these circumstances, as the district court aptly observed, it does not seem possible to parse, at least in the manner the ALJ sought to do, the paper's animus toward the union generally from its desire to protect its editorial discretion. The motions necessarily overlapped in this case. Where the motives necessarily overlap, how can right line work?
Well, I think there are two distinct answers to that question. First, factually, the board found that they did not overlap, and the board, of course, as you know, has the initial job of determining motive, of making these fact-specific determinations. It's one of the core roles of the board over decades to determine motive in unfair labor practice proceedings, and
it can't disregard the reality. I mean, as I say, you very rightly in your brief, rightly in the sense of truthfully, focus on the whole origins of this dispute.
Well, and I think, again, I do think
that... that was all before the board, too.
I do think that in any mixed motive case as this one, the board, as I said, has the primary role and benefits from deference in determining motive. But setting that aside, the board also...
Suppose the employee holds up a sign disparaging the employer with respect to matters that are not mandatory subjects of bargaining, which I think begins to look like disloyalty. And the company, and let's suppose he's engaged in a hot unionization dispute. Can the board just look at that and say, well, the real aim was to get the employee for his unionization purpose in the face of that record?
Well,
I don't know how you get to the opening lines of right line.
Well, right line applies, of course, when there's a question of mixed motive. And
yes.
As I said, I think it's the board's expertise to make those determinations. That I don't think that...
But the argument made by the district court here, how can you parse the difference between the two motives when the action that the employer is responding to is a single unified action?
Well, again, I do think that's what the board does regularly, but I think that is what the board does regularly, but I'd also just like to focus on the fact that if the two different motivations we're talking about are retaliation for unionization generally and retaliation for advocating autonomy, the board's position is that both of those motivations would be unprotected. In other words, the board held that Section 7 protects employees.
I'm sorry, you're saying that disparaging the employer on the ground of its resisting an employee's demand to take over editorial control would be a forbidden motive? That certainly sounded like what you said, and that's what seems to me is goat runs throughout your brief and the board opinion.
I'm not sure I just followed the question accurately, but I would, so let me just point out the part that concerned me. I do not think that the facts here show, nor did the board find, nor frankly did the company really argue aggressively that there is disparagement of the company's product. That's not at issue in this case.
Well, they framed it more in terms of invasion of their First Amendment rights, but analytically, I think it ends up being the same thing.
Well, I do not think that there was, that factually in this case there was not, and the board did not find, disparagement of the product. So with respect to, I want to make sure that I make the point that in East Tex, the Supreme Court recognized that Section 7, beyond, you know, term and condition bargaining and straight representation, East Tex protects...
That was advocacy in a union newspaper created in non-working space and circulated in non-working time. It was not a public disparagement of the employer or an attack on the employer's non-labor-related policies.
But I think that what that case is, it's not a perfect analogy, but what that case is relevant for is the point that employees are protected in mutual protection in advocating their position on issues that affect their interests as employees, and these employees felt strongly that they could not perform their jobs as professionals according to what they perceived to be professional norms, perform their jobs as reporters
now you seem to be explicitly bringing the issue of editorial control back in as, I take it, the primary purpose of the employer's unionization activities, but you're framing it now in terms of professional norms, so that I take it in a case where the professional norms involve seizure of editorial control, then the company can't respond or must bargain on that, I take it.
No, and I certainly did not mean to imply, and the board has not found here, that there is an obligation to bargain, but the obligation to bargain does not perfectly overlap the Section 7 rights to discuss certain issues. And what the board is reacting to here is the company's aggressive retaliatory actions against employees who simply expressed an opinion and advocated for a position and sought public support. But they, you know, those things are Section 7 protected. Now, had these employees, you know, it's just simply not the facts of this case, but in the future, the company seems to be asking this court to bar the board from protecting employee advocacy of positions relating to their employment based on a speculative theory that possibly in the future the board may require it to bargain or may, but the board's order doesn't require.
You talk of advocacy, but you're talking about advocacy in the context of demanding, not demanding, but proposing that subscribers cancel their subscriptions.
But that was
That's
simply...
That's distinctive.
The board has long recognized, and may I answer the question? Or
absolutely.
Go ahead.
The board has long recognized that employees may advocate for public support, including boycotts in favor of their positions. And, of course, the government and the board's order in this case is in no way suggesting that the company cannot respond in kind with any advocacy it cares to engage in, which it did. But there's a difference between the employees, for example, withholding work product or directly applying some sort of economic pressure, and using their persuasive skills to try to convince third parties unrelated to the dispute to support them. And, you know, the board is not requiring, obviously, that people cancel their subscriptions. The board is simply saying that the reporters have a right to ask them to. The company has a right to ask them not to.
In Hormel, the board did not affirmatively advocate that people, readers of the board's opinions, start boycotting Hormel products. But it was on the basis of that advocacy that we reversed the board.
But, of course, in Hormel, my understanding is that the issue was that the employee participating in these boycott activities was no longer engaged in a labor dispute with his employer, whereas these employees are actively engaged in a union campaign.
That's part of the reasoning of our decision, but not the only part.
And, well, I see that I'm far over my time, but...
Yeah, we have let you go over. We don't cover our lights with the same rigidity as the Supreme Court. As long as the court is engaged with counsel, we often keep counsel on their feet much longer than they'd like to be up. So I think your time is up now, and in case unless my colleagues have further
thank you, Your Honor.
Inquiry. Okay, are we? I don't see an allotment for intervener. Is
there was?
Yeah.
Okay. That. I guess I've got an earlier version of the calendar. It doesn't show up on mine. But.
Yeah. May it please the court. My name is Ira Gottlieb. I'm representing the Graphics Communication Conference of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. I'd like to follow up on the issue of autonomy and professional norms. In our brief. And in particular, footnote 3.
Where are we? Footnote 3 and what?
Footnote 3 of the union's brief. Yeah, yeah. There's a discussion about the issues that.
You must not have thought it was very important if you put it in footnote, counsel.
Well,
if you want us to read something, you should put it up where our eyes are.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. It's actually a long.
Appreciate it enough to not.
We'll
put those little things down in the gutter and bleed off the page.
Huh? We do extensively cite this court's Philadelphia Newspaper Guild case, and actually the footnote 3 is quite a long footnote, but it talks about the range of terms and conditions of employment or rules that an employer, a newspaper employer, may set forth, some of which are bargainable and some of which are not, depending on how close they are to the core of entrepreneurial enterprise and how much they actually impact the employees and their terms and conditions. Now, with respect to the demands that we've heard about that were submitted by the union on July 13th there of 2006, what happened was that the company, this is an organizing campaign. We're trying to get to the bargaining table. We haven't gotten there yet. And there were four demands. Company decided it was offended by the first one, but they were always coupled with recognition and bargaining. And the idea of the economic pressure that the union was involved in and the entire campaign at that point was to get to the table. And the reason they wanted to get to the table was because they were offended, the employees were offended by certain actions by management. And that included not just the wall apparently breaking down, in general, and again, these are slogans we're talking about.
You may not get very far on the wall breaking down. You may not get very far on the wall breaking down.
We understand that, Your Honor. Though there are employers who are actually welcome a discussion with the union and with their representative of their reporters.
It doesn't mean all of them have to.
Understood. But the union does have a right to make the attempt to get to the bargaining table and present those kinds of issues. And not only that, but one of the main issues was this discipline that was kind of a post hoc discipline imposed by the publisher when she decided that you could not publish, no longer could you publish a celebrity a home address, except that this owner imposed that discipline for that rule that she just newly established. So, and in terms of disparagement...
What was the discipline?
A written reprimand of four people. But, of course, there is, at that point, there is no telling one, you know, how high or how serious future discipline would be. And we're not, we make a distinction, Your Honor, between...
Is that claimed to be a ULP?
No, Your Honor. This was before the union actually came aboard. But
right.
the point of it, I mean, it was something that triggered the organizing.
It's not a ULP. That's not before us for...
No, but we're talking about...
You seem to be arguing that overreaction to reporters' efforts to assert editorial control somehow or other helps the union's case. I honestly...
My only point is that discipline is a subject, mandatory subject of bargaining. And if we're talking about a concern for the employer's editorial control, that's not all that was at stake. We have a range of terms and conditions and entrepreneurial control items, and we're only talking about
it. More compelling if the demands had simply been that the ownership in exercising editorial control should give notice before penalizing acts that are that it views as improper exercises of judgment.
Well, if we got
editorial judgment.
Okay, this is before we got to the bargaining table. These four demands that we've been referring to are not concrete bargaining proposals. They're only a set of items that we'd like to discuss with the employer. And if we got to the table, either with voluntary recognition or as we ended up doing through an NLRB election that happened in September of 2006, then we'd get into the concrete proposals. And we've actually been doing that. I won't comment on the success of that in this case, because that's not before this court. But the point here is that these were not bargaining proposals. This was an attempt to get to the table, and then you have a range of items, some of which are clearly terms and conditions of employment, some of which are not, and they may be part of the core of entrepreneurial control, but they still are bargainable. They're still at most
bargainable permissively.
That's correct, which means that the employer can discuss them, and there's nothing improper with the union presenting them.
The issue is taking the dispute outside the company and advocating a subscriber boycott on the basis of the reporter's view.
That's right, and what the union was trying to do was trying to get voluntary recognition. The union, and July 13th, it was asking for voluntary recognition so it wouldn't have to go through the board process, so that it would have been done in a more expeditious manner. As it turned out, we went to an election in September. Bargaining started in November of 2007 because there was a rather tedious process in between. But that was what the boycott was about, was to get to the table so that these issues could be fleshed out in detail. And again, autonomy is about professional norms, which are terms and conditions of employment. We're talking about discipline, talking about just cause, which is common in collective bargaining agreements, byline protection, which is giving the employee...
We have gotten you well past your time now as well, so unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up, counsel. Seeing none. Now, we will give back 2 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. That's a permissive and not a mandatory 2 minutes.
I'll be very brief. I was able to find at least two references in the transcript of the hearing where Judge Chantel that... with respect to this issue being, you know, litigated for the ALJ, and one reference is appendix page 1134, where counsel for the general counsel on the record says, I don't contest the publisher's right to control the content. And then another page in the transcript, the ALJ is commenting on the same thing here. Let's see here. The ALJ at page 3620 of the transcript makes 3628 states we have here the meshing of two considerations, the right Congress has given in the National Labor Relations Act for bargaining and the First Amendment rights and property rights of the publisher, that all this is in play. So this is on the record with the ALJ.
What's the ALJ do with that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, so
I'm just
having so said. What happened?
Yeah. You know. What happened?
I'm just responding to the fact that this was litigated from the beginning in answer to Judge Sentell's earlier question. And I just want to make two final points. I mean, it seems to me that the board and the intervener are complaining that they don't think that the Santa Barbara News Press runs a responsible newspaper, and the Supreme Court has addressed that and said that a responsible press is an undoubtedly desirable goal, but press responsibility is not mandated by the Constitution. Like many other virtues, it cannot be legislated. And finally, Justice White in that case said a newspaper or magazine is not a public utility subject to reasonable government regulation in matters affecting the exercise of journalistic judgment as to what shall be printed. We have learned and continue to learn from what we view as the unhappy experience of other nations, where government has been allowed to meddle in the internal editorial affairs of newspapers. Thank you.
Your time is up, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.